From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The conservative movement that carried Ronald Reagan to victory barely exists anymore, writes John Judis. He says the movement has dissipated into cantankerous and confused factions. Judis is the author of a biography of William Buckley and a new book on the end of the American century. On today's Fresh Air, John Judis on American conservatism. Also, we talk with Gary Sinise, the director and star of a new film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. Sinise is a co-founder of the Steppenwolf Theater, where John Malkovich and Laurie Metcalf got started. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Last of the Mohegans, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Tailhook sexual assault scandal has ended the careers of two Navy admirals who were dismissed today for failing to pursue and punish sexual abusers at last year's Tailhook Aviators Convention. Acting Navy Secretary Sean O'Keefe said today that he was replacing Rear Admirals Duval Williams Jr. and John Gordon. Williams heads the Naval Investigative Service and Gordon is the Navy's top lawyer. Both officers will retire. Rear Admiral George Washington Davis, the Navy's Inspector General, will be reassigned. The dismissals were announced after the Pentagon's chief investigator said that senior Navy officers failed to take action against the men accused of assaulting at least 26 women at the convention. The co-chairmen of the International Conference on Yugoslavia are making an emergency trip to Bosnia tomorrow to head off what they fear is a new effort by Serbian forces to push Muslims and Croats out of Serbian-controlled areas. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Zagreb.
Cyrus Vance of the United Nations and Lord Owen of the European Community are flying to Banja Luka, a Serb-held city in northern Bosnia. Banja Luka is one of the few Serb-occupied cities in Bosnia that still has a sizable Muslim population. But United Nations officials on the ground in Banja Luka say they've heard that nationalist Serb leaders have recently issued an order to cleanse the city of non-Serb residents. UN officials are reporting a new wave of bombings and intimidation directed at the Muslim population. Several Muslim leaders have been arrested. Vance and Owen are also worried about a general breakdown of law and order in the area around Banja Luka. An extremist Serb faction has reportedly taken authority in its own hands. The International Red Cross has been forced to delay a planned evacuation of 1,600 detainees from a Serb camp in the area because of opposition from local Serb leaders. I'm Tom Jelton in Zagreb.
The Senate voted today to override President Bush's veto of the family leave bill. The measure now moves on to the House. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The family leave legislation calls for companies with more than 50 employees to grant them unpaid leave for a period of up to 12 weeks. Supporters say this will allow parents to tend to their newborn or sick children or to care for other family members. Democrats said the bill was a manifestation of family values, but Republicans maintained it was an unfair mandate on companies and a Democratic attempt to embarrass President Bush in an election year. Republicans proposed an alternative plan that would give tax breaks to companies who agreed to provide leave time. The vote in the Senate to override the Democrats' plan was 68-31. Republicans are confident they can sustain the veto in the House, where the bill passed with less than a two-thirds majority. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over 9 points to close at 3,288. This is NPR News. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger met today with Russia's foreign minister to express U.S. concern over Russia's sales of three submarines to Iran. The non-nuclear subs would bring Russia about $750 million in much-needed foreign exchange. Eagleburger condemned the sale of the three submarines to Iran's radical government, but said there's little the United States can do. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council, who are also the world's biggest arms merchants, have agreed to restrict arms sales to the Middle East. President Bush recently approved the sale of 72 F-15 fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. Teachers in Detroit remained on the picket line today despite a judge's order that they go back to work. The strike in the nation's seventh largest school district is now 4 weeks old. Don Gagne reports.
Detroit's 10,500 public school teachers were told to return to the classroom today, but only a handful did so. The rest were marching in picket lines, holding signs which read, "No contract, no work." Nacresha Chapman has taught in the district for nearly 30 years.
It's been very difficult because most of us have not been working for 3 months. So it's a sacrifice, it's painful, but ultimately, if we have no contract, we subject ourselves to all kinds of horrendous situations.
It's not clear what action will be taken against teachers for defying the court order. In the meantime, contract negotiations have resumed. The major stumbling block in the talks has been money. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Four National Football League players have, at least temporarily, won their fight for free agency. A federal judge in Minneapolis has issued an order making free agents of Philadelphia tight end Keith Jackson and three other players for the next 5 days. The four players had filed an antitrust lawsuit against the league's Plan B, which allows each team to prevent 37 players from signing with other teams. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a recent article titled "The End of Conservatism," political writer John Judis concluded that the American conservative movement has slipped into chaos and impotence. The article was published in The New Republic, where Judis is a contributing editor. He wrote about the growth of the contemporary conservative movement a few years ago in his book, William Buckley, Patron Saint of the Conservatives. John Judis has a new book called Grand Illusion, in which he chronicles the attempts by American politicians, businessmen, and intellectuals to come to terms with the dawn and then the sunset of the American century. In the epilogue, Judis asks, where are today's philosophers and critics, the vibrant new political and social movements? Where is the spirit of experimentation, and where are the political leaders?
Well, I was making a contrast between the beginning of the century when America was a rising power in the world and the end of the century when we're a declining power and when we face the same kind of challenge of redefining who we are and what our task in the world is. And what strikes me is the contrast between that earlier period and this later period, not only between the quality of the presidents that we've had now and then. You can put Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson against Bush, Reagan, Carter, Ford, but also the quality of our intellectual life. And the beginning of the century, the time of John Dewey, William James, Thorsten Veblen. I mean, we had a whole host of innovators in philosophy, sciences, history, and now it's very hard to find the same people.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that people aren't reading as much as they did or reading serious books as much as they did, and that, you know, television has dominated the landscape and maybe we're getting pundits instead of philosophers?
I think it has to do with something worse than that. I think that when a country begins to decline economically, when it begins to lose its place in the world, it also begins to decline ideologically, that the two processes go together.
You've been writing a lot about the history of the contemporary conservative movement. You wrote about that in your biography of William Buckley and in a recent article in The New Republic. Your recent article reached the conclusion that the conservative movement, which carried Reagan to victory, barely exists anymore. You say it's dissipated into factions. Its ideas have become obsolete or discredited. What makes you believe that this movement barely exists anymore?
Well, you have to understand that there always are going to be conservatives with a small c in American politics, just that there always will be liberals with a small l and Democrats with a small d. It's a question of whether there is a coherent movement that has certain common ideas that can go forth into a battle and win a majority in America. And I think that movement, which was based largely on a militant anti-communism, and on a certain economic platform summed up in the supply-side economics of Reagan, that movement no longer exists except as a very narrow shell and as a group of competing factions.
What are the factions?
Well, mainly a lot of them are based in Washington. You have people around, for instance, Jack Kemp, who still cling to the idea of supply-side economics, but at the same time have a genuine concern about the society, about the poor in the society, and about the cities. You have a more kind of old guard conservatives represented by Bill Graham, who are mostly concerned about balancing the budget, and who really don't have this view of trying to create social harmony and of representing all the people. Then you have the religious right. They have their own agenda. And I think that you could see already in 1988, if you want to look at the kind of bitter fight that came about between Jack Kemp and Pat Robertson in the primaries, you could see there the beginning of the splintering of the movement itself and the lack of any common leader upon which they could all agree.
Of the factions within the conservative movement now, which factions do you think are behind Bush and which aren't?
I think that there are no factions really that are behind Bush. There are a number of leaders who have a vested interest in supporting him, but I couldn't really identify a movement that was behind him. I was at Pat Robertson's Christian Victory Conference a few weeks ago, and they made a big deal over how much they supported Bush. But when I actually talked to people who attended the conference, I couldn't find any enthusiasm whatsoever. And I think you find that in Washington, too, if you talk to the people who are officially endorsing them. Privately, they'll say that they don't care. Some of them would rather have Clinton because they feel that they need the time to regroup. So I think that there's very little enthusiasm for Bush.
What effect, if any, do you think that's having on the Bush administration?
Well, I think the effect it's had on Bush is that domestically he has never had really a program or a direction, and he's always looked elsewhere for it. And the fact that the conservative movement has itself splintered and lost any idea of where it wanted to take the country meant that Bush himself was at a loss. The example I would use would be the budget debate in 1990. Where Bush was trying to figure out a way to cut the deficit, and where he finally got hooked into agreeing to increase taxes, which he, I'm sure, privately thought he had to do, and where the conservatives provided him really with no alternative and no alternative program. But when he did finally come out with this budget agreement, denounced him and disassociated themselves from him. So, in effect, they didn't provide a solution. They just provided a part of the opposition. And I think that was it was at that point where it was clear that Bush really had nowhere to go domestically.
Well, how comfortable were the factions of the conservative movement ever with George Bush?
They were never. He was always a lesser of evils for them, I think. He always had the taint of being from the Ivy League and being a kind of a country club Republican, as they used to say, from the Trilateral Commission. So he was always seen in some senses as being the best they could get at the moment, but they would have preferred somebody else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Judas, author of the new book, Grand Illusion. He also is a contributing editor of The New Republic and a Washington correspondent for In These Times. You consider the current conservative movement to be about 35 years old. Why that cutoff point? What happened 35 years ago?
Well, 35 years ago was when National Review started Buckley's magazine. It's when Barry Goldwater first became a national leader. It's when it's also when Whitaker Chambers' Witness was published. It's when a number of events conspired to give this a new movement, a unity around these ideas of a communist threat. Before that, many of the people on the right, you couldn't have found something called the conservative movement. But many people on the right were isolationists. They didn't believe that America should have a strong military. They worried about the Pentagon dominating society. And many of them were against the Korean War. And the crucial change was the recognition by people like Buckley and Goldwater that it was necessary to go along really with what had been a liberal program of fighting and containing communism. They just wanted to take it one step farther and actually roll back communism.
Now, what about fringy, racist, anti-Semitic groups that have been on the far, far right. Where did they fit in under this new conservative music movement that begins at about the time of William Buckley?
There always were, in America, and particularly in the 20th century, groups that were nativists, that worried about immigrants, that were anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, racist, what have you. What happened in the 50s, and I think that Buckley's National Review was instrumental in doing this, was that Buckley tried to create a new respectable conservatism and to weed out these groups. And there were a number of incidents during that period where he took particular steps to dissociate conservatives, first from the anti-Semites on the American Mercury, this magazine that was important at the time, then from the John Birch Society, the people that thought that Dwight Eisenhower was a communist. And later in the 60s, in the late 60s, National Review dissociated itself from George Wallace, seeing him as simply being a racist. So I think that there was this kind of attempt to create a respectable conservatism, and by the time you get Ronald Reagan and that generation, they are really products of that process.
Where do you see neoconservatives like Irving Kristol fitting in?
They come about in the 70s. Neoconservative means that they were people who were liberals. Many of them were against the Vietnam War, like Norman Podoritz. And they had a moment of conversion in the late 60s and moved steadily to the right until they found themselves in the conservative camp and supporting Reagan in 1980. Some of those people, though, have started to come back. With the Cold War's end, the basis of their own conversion has really been taken out from under them, and they're beginning to look back at the Democratic Party.
Neoconservatives are doing that, you think?
Yes, absolutely.
No, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's happening in Washington. There's people like Josh Moravchik at the American Enterprise Institute, the columnist Ben Wattenberg, you can hear quite a few of them now, reconsidering their ties to the Democratic Party because in some respects they still remain Democrats, for instance, in their support for the New Deal and for the basic idea that government has a responsibility for taking care of those who can't take care of themselves. I think that that's something they continue to share with the Democrats.
Well, how else do you think the end of the Cold War has affected the conservative movement?
Well, I think that's about the main ways in which it's affected the conservative movement is by removing the one basis of unity that held together all the factions. And so I think that without it, what really happened was that all these tendencies that had been suppressed, laid aside, and to all extent and purposes had vanished over the last 30 years, suddenly came back to the surface. It was a kind of return of the repressed, so that you have the David Dukes, the Pat Buchanans, all these kind of things that really had been forbidden in terms of what was respectable conservative politics are now back.
In talking about the factionalization of the conservative movement, is there anything you could point to during the Republican convention that would exemplify the factionalization you're describing?
Oh, I think that all the battles over abortion. Now, abortion itself was never an accepted part of the Republican platform until the 1970s. Reagan himself had signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country when he was governor of California. But it became kind of a cause celeb under the idea that was a way of attracting many of these social conservatives through the religious right, particularly that happened in the late 70s. And conservatives closed rank around it. But I think now what you're beginning to see is a younger generation of conservatives that no longer hearken to those kind of ideas and that are much more liberal in their social views. William Weld, the governor of Massachusetts, is a good example of that kind of conservative. And so the debate over abortion is a very factional debate now within the conservative movement and the Republican Party, and it really threatens to tear the party apart.
My guest is John Judas, contributing editor of The New Republic and Washington correspondent for In These Times. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Judas, author of the new book Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. Why did you start writing about the history of the conservative movement? And I'll point out again that you're the author of a biography of William Buckley.
Well, I think part of the reason was that I was a 60s radical, and I had a certain interest in ideas and in movements. And by the middle 70s, I could see my side of the movement and also the liberal movement itself having pretty well dissipated. And whatever interesting intellectually was happening in American society was happening among conservatives. That's what the magazines were more interesting, the debates were more interesting. And I began to gravitate toward my reporting toward watching the conservatives. And when Reagan got elected, I wanted to figure out why that had happened and where it had all started. And that was the reason I got involved in writing a biography of Buckley.
Now, you went to the University of California at Berkeley, which in the 60s and 70s had a reputation as being one of the most radical campuses in the country. When were you there, and what were you going through personally?
I went there. I left. I was one of the early dropouts from the East. I went to Amherst, and I quit after 2 years, and I went to Berkeley in 1962, and I graduated from there, and then I went to graduate school in philosophy. And I think I went through the same kind of experiences that many of the people who were kind of coming of age politically now went through in terms of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War. It was a time of, I was radicalized during that period.
And can you point to a specific experience a few years later that made you think that the left wasn't where it was happening anymore, that the left had changed?
Well, the experience really that was the in 1969, I'd been a member of SDS in California, and in June 1969, there was this convention in Chicago, which everybody expected that a movement and a party would finally come out of it that would march down history, and that was the convention out of which Weatherman emerged. This kind of crazy radical sect that thought that it could make a revolution on behalf of the Third World in America by breaking the windows of Volkswagens and police cars. And it was at that moment that I realized that the left, which I harbored these illusions that we were going to march forward, was really beginning to march backward, and we were in deep trouble, as indeed we were.
Now, did that change your political ideas, or did it just change your ideas about the leadership within the left?
Well, it changed my, it certainly changed my ideas about the leadership within the left. And I think for the next 5 or 6 years, I was part of an organization called the New American Movement that we tried to develop an alternative to these kind of radical politics that was much more democratic. That was based on elections rather than violence. And so I attempted for about 5 or 6 years to do that, and then I felt that the effort was, that it was really getting nowhere, and I decided that I had to spend more time reading, writing. It was at that time that I decided to become a journalist, which meant that I had to look at things with my own eyes and report what happened, even if it disagreed with what my ideological preconceptions were. And that was a very educational experience.
What's an example of a time when looking at something carefully, you had to come to a conclusion that really surprised you?
I'll have to think about that. I can tell you what my final thing that made me decide that I had to get out of the organized left was. That was a,
yeah.
I certainly remember that.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was in 1976, and I was still a member of this organization. And
NAM, the New American Movement?
Yes, and we were in I was in California in the Bay Area, and we were deciding whether or not to support the Tom Hayden Senate bid. And to me, it just seems totally obvious that we should do so. And we had this heated debate. We had a convention where all the California members got together. And people were trotting out all these quotations from Lenin and people like that. And it suddenly occurred to me that I was involved in this kind of massive game where in order to reach conclusions that were obvious, I had to go through the detour of all these quasi-religious texts with quotations from Marx or Lenin and this whole history of misunderstanding. And that really that was it was a needless detour, and that I had to get away from that and really begin looking at what was happening in the United States and to understand better our history.
When you started writing about the conservative movement and when you started writing your biography of Buckley, were you distrusted as possibly a liberal spy?
Well, I had a lot of trouble initially convincing Buckley that he should cooperate with me. It took about 7 months. One reason was I'd done this scathing profile of him in the Progressive magazine, which besides being scathing contained several stupid errors that I could have avoided if I was more careful. And I think he was worried not only that I would do a hatchet job, but that I would screw it up. But after about 6 or 7 months, he did give his consent. And from that point on, I was able to see many of the people. But I think still, through the whole writing of the book, I did experience a certain amount of distrust.
And what about now?
Now, yes and no. I think a lot of conservatives like me because I'm one of the few people who is actually interested in their ideas. I think many reporters are not very interested in what people really think. They're more interested in who's going to win and who's going to lose. And so I think that that's probably a plus.
I want to get back to a question that you raised in your book, which is where are the vibrant new political and social movements, the vibrant new political leaders? Do you see any movements or leaders beginning to come of age now that are of interest to you?
Well, I think that what we're really going to have to look at is what's happening in the Democratic Party. I think that's the most interesting thing now. And Clinton and the people around him and whether that will represent a genuine change or whether it's going to turn into another kind of Carter-esque stalemate. And I think if you look at it from certain respects, when you look at it from these are people who understand how to work government. They understand that we at this point that we have to do something to revive our industry. I think that's a hopeful sign. If you look at it from the standpoint of problems like the deficit, you can fall into despair very quickly.
Do you think you would ever be able to be a member of a large political group now?
I sort of like being on the sidelines myself. I prefer it, and I think I function better that way.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Judis. His new book is called Grand Illusion, Critics and Champions of the American Century. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Burgess Meredith and Lon Chaney starred in the 1939 film Of Mice and Men. Now Gary Sinise and John Malkovich star in a new film adaptation of the John Steinbeck novel. Coming up, we meet Sinise, who also directed the film. Sinise and Malkovich worked together for many years in the Steppenwolf Theater, which Sinise co-founded. There's also a new film adaptation of James Fenimore Cooper's novel, The Last of the Mohicans. Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the Navy has announced that three top-ranking admirals will lose their jobs for mishandling an investigation into last year's so-called Tailhook Convention in Las Vegas. At that convention, 26 women were sexually assaulted by Navy and Marine aviators. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The Navy's top lawyer and the commander of the Naval Investigative Service have both resigned. The Navy's Inspector General will be reassigned. The changes came after a Pentagon report was released today. The report said the men failed to fully investigate the Tailhook scandal, in some cases because they wanted to protect the reputation of senior Navy officials. Acting Secretary of the Navy Sean O'Keefe said the Navy understands it must do more than dismiss a few people at the top.
We know that the larger issue is a cultural problem which has allowed demeaning behavior and attitudes toward women to exist within the Navy Department.
O'Keefe said Navy employees and officers will continue to receive training about sexual harassment and alcoholism. There are also efforts to put more women in higher-ranking positions. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Also in Washington, a sixth round of Middle Eastern peace talks ended today with Israeli, Jordanian, Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian delegates promising to return to Washington October 21st for the next round of talks. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
There were no breakthroughs, but all the delegations agreed that the latest talks were useful. In each set of negotiations, Israeli and Arab positions are still far apart, but the talks have fostered mutual understanding, the delegates say. Israel and Syria did not reach the hoped-for statement of joint principles, but they did agree that UN Resolution 242, calling on Israel to exchange land for peace, was the proper basis for the talks, and they agreed that both sides have the right to protect their security. In the Israeli-Palestinian talks, there are now two proposals for interim self-government on the table. Again, the gap is wide. Delegates hope to narrow it next time. All delegations expressed disappointment that there was not more progress, but at least they say they are now dealing with substantive issues. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The government says that new claims for jobless benefits moved up again in the middle of the month for the fourth increase in a row. New claims topped 400,000 for the first time since early in August. The Labor Department says that first-time applications for unemployment rose by 15,000 in the week ending September 12th to 414,000. Some of the new claims came from hurricane victims in Florida and Louisiana. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 9 points to close at 3,287.87 on volume of more than 189 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to override President Bush's veto of a family leave bill by a vote of 68 to 31. It's the first time the Senate has voted to overturn a Bush veto, and voting to override were 54 Democrats and 14 Republicans. Supporters of the bill concede that there are probably not enough votes in the House to override the measure. The bill calls on businesses with 50 or more employees to give workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave every year in the case of a family medical emergency. The president vetoed the bill late Tuesday night. In London, British Prime Minister John Major faced an unruly House of Commons as Parliament held an emergency debate on last week's collapse of the British pound. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The Prime Minister came straight to the point. Britain would remain outside the exchange rate mechanism, the system which fixes the value of currencies among the members of the European community, until it was reformed. At the height of last week's run on the pound, the government was forced to take the currency out of the ERM. He told the noisy House of Commons, "We shall not go back into the same mechanism that we left last week." He blamed injudicious comments by foreign figures for last week's devaluation of the pound. Major was continually interrupted, frequently by members of his own Conservative Party, many of whom are against closer European political and economic ties. In response to the Prime Minister's speech, the new leader of the opposition Labour Party, John Smith, called Major the devalued leader of a devalued government. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Iran's oil minister says his country is increasing its oil production by some 400,000 barrels a day, thus turning aside OPEC's plan to hold output steady in order to push up oil prices this winter. In protest, Iran felt did not go far enough. Oil production in the nation will be increased to meet demand. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There's a new film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Depression-era novel of Mice and Men. My guest Gary Sinise directed the film and stars in the role of George, which was played by Burgess Meredith in the 1939 film. John Malkovich plays the hulking but mentally slow Lenny, who was played by Lon Chaney. Sinise and Malkovich worked together for years in Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater Company, which Sinise co-founded and directed. Steppenwolf also launched the career of Laurie Metcalf, who now co-stars on Roseanne as Roseanne's sister. The company has become internationally known for its innovative productions. Sinise starred in and directed a Steppenwolf production of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. It opened in Chicago and moved to Broadway, where it won a Tony Award for Best Play. Sinise received a Tony nomination for his role as Tom Joad. I asked Sinise why he wanted to remake Of Mice and Men.
I actually became very familiar with and friendly with Elaine Steinbeck, John's widow, during the development of The Grapes of Wrath. It was while we were on Broadway that I asked her if she would give me the rights to Of Mice and Men, because I knew that our run on Broadway was ending soon, and I was going to go back to Los Angeles, where I live, and try to make movies again. And I wanted to go back with a very specific project, and this was a story that I loved.
As someone who not only got your start on stage, but is, you know, internationally renowned for what you've achieved on stage, do you have something of an approach avoidance relationship with movies?
No, I want to do it. It's much easier to do theater. You know, you don't need a lot of money to do theater. That's one of the things my high school teacher always said, and that's why I started my own company, is if you want to act, just go find a space and do it and act. And it's very easy. You don't need any money to go find a basement somewhere and put some actors together and get a couple of chairs and, you know, do a play. That doesn't take any money, but to make a movie, you know, you've got to rent the camera equipment, the editing equipment, you've got to process the film, you've got to cut it together, you've got to put some music in there, that all costs money, then you've got to find something, then you've got to finish it and dub it and finish it all. You've got to pay the actors, you've got to pay the camera crew, you've got to pay all those people, the costume designers and everybody, then you've got to find somebody with a screen, you know, that'll play that movie. And in theater, it doesn't take that. I wanted to immediately go to work as an actor and not come to Hollywood or go to New York and bang on somebody's door and hope that I could get a part. But we were an actor's company who wanted to go right to work and do difficult and challenging roles right from the beginning. It wasn't about making a living at that point. It was about making good theater and growing as actors. And I think on that whole history and that bed of nurturing really helped me. And now I feel like I'm starting a whole new phase. I'm able to kind of transfer from stage into film in a way that a lot of actors don't have that kind of background.
Well, you once described yourself as a troubled, mixed-up kid who turned around his life in high school in a production of West Side Story.
Oh. Where'd you read that?
Oh. It's an article. I couldn't tell you which one.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right? I mean,
I did say that. I must have said that because that is true. I was kind of a screwed-up rock and roller in high school, and then me and some rock and roll buddies of mine I played in a lot of bands, so I always did like performing. And me and some of the rock and roll guys from the band saw that they were performing West Side Story, and we thought it'd be fun to go jump around and be in a gang. So we went and tried out, and a bunch of us got in it, and all of a sudden I discovered this other thing that I really loved, and it was this teacher in high school that kind of brought that out of me and reinforced something that I guess was inside there, but I just didn't know it was there.
I know a lot of men always thought it was silly to have singing and dancing gang members. That didn't bother you?
At that time, no. I mean, there were girls in the play.
Oh, I see.
It was fun. They were all of a sudden dancing with girls, and girls were around, and it was a way to meet girls at that time too. You know.
So you were a shark.
I was a shark.
So what did you do to be Puerto Rican?
Makeup.
Uh huh.
That was kind of funny because this is, you know, it's the North Shore of Chicago. There aren't a lot of Puerto Ricans up in Highland Park, so you know, we did the makeup, and you know, I was Peppy the Shark.
So did you get any featured songs? I mean, did you get featured lines within songs?
No, I had a couple lines, you know, like bottles or knives or guns or something. Chains.
What are you going to rumble with?
Yeah, yeah, right. Rumble. I don't know what I said, but it wasn't, it was very moving. I remember, that was at a time in my life where we had just moved. We had moved around a lot, and moving as a high school kid, you know, when you're that age, you know, you're really rooted in your friends, and you're making acquaintances, and and when you move away from that, it's very difficult for a young person to, like, find a new group of friends. And so I was kind of very rebellious and not getting along well with my parents at that time. So I was having a lot of trouble in high school. I wasn't going to class, and I wasn't reading or studying or doing anything until I discovered the theater. And all of a sudden it made me want to go to school and just work in the scene shop and paint sets and hang out with these theater people that were very different from the kind of folks that I was hanging out with. And this teacher was somebody who really turned me around. You know, I can't say that I had one of those teachers that had enormous effect on me. And all of a sudden my parents were, you know, all of a sudden because of that, I started communicating with my parents in a way that we hadn't been communicating for a while. And they started coming to see the plays, and all of a sudden, a troubled kind of kid who was really looking for something, all of a sudden, his family life changed, and his, you know, schooling changed. I still graduated late because I was such a jerk in the early part of my high school that I didn't have enough credits. But still, I found something that really made me want to learn.
My guest is Gary Sinise. He directed and co-stars in a new film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Sinise is my guest, co-founder of the Steppenwolf Theater Company. You were 18 when you co-founded Steppenwolf Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So were you still in high school then, or were you out?
I had just gotten out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I went immediately and found a church and just kept doing, you know, theater. We just asked this church if they would let us work in there at night and do theater, and they said yes. And I just kept on doing it.
Critics have used words like brave and daring to describe some of the performances in Steppenwolf Theater Company. When you directed shows, did you feel that you were really pushing people to the edge of their own capabilities? What does it mean to be brave and daring on stage?
Well, I think being stupid is part of it.
What do you mean by that?
Just being kind of silly and stupid is part of it. I mean exactly that, being uninhibited enough to let anything come out and to attempt anything without restriction. And that's one of the things that, because we were isolated in this basement And, you know, it was 20 miles north of Chicago, and there wasn't any other theater around there. It's not like we were in, you know, one of many groups in a theater community. We were isolated in this little basement in a suburb. And it was almost like we, you know, at a certain point, we didn't care who came or how they reacted. We were just doing it for ourselves. And so we were kind of rebellious and kind of idiotic, and we just, you know, there was the one time I can remember us trying to, you know, get some people into the seats and do something for the audience was a miserable failure. We thought, well, let's do a musical.
What'd you do?
We put our own musical together. It was called Mac Anything Goes Over the Rainbow. And it was a Harold Arlen, Cole Porter, and Kurt Vile songs. And it was kind of a hodgepodge of all their stuff. And we thought, well, let's make some money. Let's do a musical. You know, nobody's coming to see our axe-murdering plays. And, you know, these bleak things that we were doing and, you know, dangerous things. Nobody's coming, so let's do a musical. Well, I mean, you can't just do a musical. You have to be able to sing or dance or something. So it was a horrible failure. And that was that. After that, we decided let's never again attempt to do something simply for the audience that we will think will make money or be commercial or bring in a crowd. But let's just stick to our guns and do what we want. So there were many times where people just didn't show up to the plays, and I can remember we didn't care. We'd just entertain each other that night. We'd go out and get some beer and put on a play. We'd just improvise for each other and kind of do these things all night. We called random nights, and we'd do a random night whenever we wouldn't get an audience, and that was quite often.
What if there was one person in the audience? Would you do the play, or would you do the random night?
If there was one person in the audience, yes, we would do the play. We would ask, you know, I mean, whoever was an usher or selling tickets that night, we'd just have them go sit with that person so they wouldn't feel so bad. We'd do the show.
I think John Malkovich was the first person from Steppenwolf to break out into movies and to really become nationally known. Were you at all jealous when that started happening?
That was a difficult time for our entire theater company. I remember I was the artistic director of Steppenwolf. This was 1982. And I was the artistic director and also the director of the first play that we took to New York called True West by Sam Shepard. And at that time, we were. I was very much pushing to kind of open our, you know, scope and look for a new audience and build our audience into a more nationally based audience. So in 1982, I decided to take one of our shows, and it was True West, and John and I went and were in the show at the same time. And I remember. You know, both of us were on stage the whole time. He did get, you know, a lot of attention. The role was very flashy. He was very good in it. And there were times where it was difficult. I remember, and the producers of that particular play made it more difficult because they would do things to pit John and I against each other and make me feel like I was not as important. And that was difficult, seeing as it was me who put it together in the first place. But once John got all the press, they obviously were focusing more on him than myself. And there was one time I came in, you know, and John said, well, I finally got my second raise. And I said, what do you mean your second raise? When did you get your first raise? I said, I didn't get any raise. And so I went to the producers and I said, well, what do you mean you've given John two raises? You know, you didn't give me, you know, that's not fair. We're both up there at the same time. You know, I'm the director of the play. I brought the show. We had this thing. I made it happen. I talked him into doing it. I said, well, I'm gonna give you 2 weeks' notice if you don't give me at least one raise. They said, go ahead.
Whoa. Wow, that must have really hurt.
That really hammered something home to me at that time. And John, at that time, was going out every night with Antonioni or somebody else, you know. And I was trying to get the producers to give me another raise, or just one raise, just to make me feel like they weren't going to say, screw you, and, you know, you're not important. And That part of it was difficult. I never had any problem with John getting any attention that he deserved because he's very good, and you know, this was certainly a role of kind of a lifetime, and he put his stamp on this role, and I'm glad, you know. But I did direct it, and I did you know, make it happen, and the producers of that particular show kind of ignored that fact at a certain point, and that became difficult to deal with. But John and I are still very close. We have no problems, and you know, we get along obviously very well. So it didn't affect our relationship.
So when the producers,
I just learned something about the business at that point that I didn't know.
When the producers basically told you, if you don't like it, you're welcome to leave, did you leave?
No, because the bottom line was it was my show, and it wasn't their show, and my leaving was not good for my play. And John and I were up there together, and it was important that I stay for the show.
You know, people always say never give an ultimatum unless you'll really follow through on it.
Well, I thought they would give me a raise. I thought they'd say, okay, oh, sorry, oh, yeah, I we feel bad about that, and we'll give you a raise. I thought that's the kind of relationship I had with these guys.
Does this story help explain why you've produced, directed, and starred in Of Mice and Men?
Controlling my own work has always been something that was much more preferable, you know, and much more desirable. And that's why I started my own theater and didn't go out and go to New York or go to Los Angeles and get a job as a waiter and bang on doors and try and get an agent and hope that I could get one line on Knott's Landing or something like that, and that would lead to some other kind of thing. It was much more important to me to have control over my creative destiny in that way, and it's never made me very much money or anything like that, but it has given me a confidence in what I can do and what I'm good at, and I must admit that the challenge of acting, producing, and directing this particular novel was something I couldn't pass up. I mean, nobody came to me with the idea. I had it myself. But it was also something that I was really prepared for and ready for and up for. There are a lot of people that direct their own things and act in them. And, you know, I believe that I, you know, have, you know, enough energy to do that as well.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Sinise is the director and star of the new movie Of Mice and Men. It opens in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles Friday, October 2nd, and nationally the following week. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, you remember the sexual harassment scandal, which goes by the name of Tailhook, about the way the Navy has treated women officers. Some Navy officers lost their careers over that scandal today. We will look at that, and we'll hear about women who are serving in the Navy now and what their lives are like. Governor Clinton is talking about the plan he has to reorganize American health care. Mike Schuster is reporting from Moscow about the KGB, which he says is alive and well in what used to be the Soviet Union. And we'll have listener letters.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Michael Mann is famous for sleek, high-tech crime movies like Thief and Manhunter, and of course for inventing the sleek, high-tech TV shows Miami Vice and Crime Story. So what's he doing out in the woods, directing an adaptation of James Fenimore Cooper's musty classic, The Last of the Mohegans? Film critic Stephen Schiff explains.
This is a puzzling movie, but as I watched it, I kept feeling there was something terribly familiar about its tone. What else have we all seen that's this somber and fervent, without actually making much sense? What else has this same feeling of men living and dying by powerful but not exactly coherent moral codes? What else has this sort of mysterious, impenetrable hero and a romance that's extremely ardent without ever being quite believable? Above all, what else has this kind of intense, perfectly choreographed violence, complete with tricky kicks and flips and lots of blood? That's right, The Last of the Mohicans turns out to be a samurai movie with tomahawks. In other words, like many Americans trying to figure out how to be as sleek and high-tech as possible, Michael Mann has turned to the Japanese for inspiration. And on the whole, the results work. The story is about Hawkeye, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, and more often called Nathaniel in the movie. He's the peerless white woodsman who was raised by the Mohican chief Chingachgook, and now he and his foster brother, the Mohican Uncas, know everything there is to know about hunting and trapping and creeping through the woods without stepping on noisy branches. Okay. Meanwhile, back at Fort Edward, beautiful Cora, played by Madeline Stowe, and her sister, played by Jodie May, have to get to Fort Henry, where their father is a crusty British general fighting off the French. On the way, they get ambushed by Huron Indians, who are allies of the French, and just when the situation seems hopeless, along come Hawkeye and Uncas and Chingachgook to rescue the maidens and help them get to Fort Henry. Along the way, Hawkeye and Cora take a moment for one of those taunting cat-and-mouse conversations that always mean love is on the horizon.
Chingachgook, you warned me about people like you.
Oh, he did.
He said, do not try to understand them.
What?
Yes, and do not try to make them understand you. That is because they are a breed apart and make no sense.
Breed apart? We make no sense? You are right, Mr. Poe. We do not understand what is happening here. And it's not as I imagined it would be, thinking of it in Boston and London.
Sorry to disappoint you.
No, on the contrary. It is more deeply stirring to my blood than any imagining could possibly have been.
You can hear how Madeline Stowe sounds like a breathy English beauty losing her accent to the wilderness. And you can hear how Daniel Day-Lewis sounds like John Wayne with marbles in his mouth. They're both very good in this movie, though, and very sexy, but there's never a moment when you feel as if you know either of them. In some ways, this movie plays like a gothic romance. The raven-tressed, headstrong girl gets taken into a world of mystery and peril by a man who's half savage, half noble. And Daniel Day-Lewis has the grace and beauty and burning eyes to make a perfect frontier Heathcliff. The film is wonderful to look at, with action scenes that come thick and fast at the tops of sheer cliffs or by thundering waterfalls. It's safe to say you've never seen anything like it. This movie does sweep you up, but it also evaporates the moment you leave the theater. And the reason is that it has no humor, no looseness, no feeling that there are people alive inside it. Every emotion and every action feel drawn not from life, but from other movies. And those movies are made in Japan.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Ben Stiller. He's the son of the comedy team Stiller and Mira, and he's gone into the family business. He's starring in his own TV sketch comedy series, which premieres this weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
I want to see you at the 91 FM Afropop Dance Party, Sunday, October 18.